Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to the programme. I'm Justin Briley with you this Saturday afternoon between now and 4 o'clock. And whether you're listening live this Saturday afternoon or online via premier.org.uk/unbelievable, or indeed you download the podcast regularly, it's great to have you with me. My thanks to those who have been before. And don't forget that after this programme, Dave and B with Hip Rock UK between 4 and 6 o'clock this afternoon. You're unbelievable. But this is the point of the Saturday afternoon where Christians and non-Christians get together to discuss. And, well, we are obviously entering Holy Week now, Palm Sunday tomorrow, and we're looking at the resurrection from a Muslim standpoint. It's our great pleasure to have with us Shabir Ali in the studio for the programme today. He is one of the foremost, if you like, Muslim thinkers and apologists when it comes to the Muslim faith. He's going to be explaining why he doesn't believe in the resurrection of Jesus, indeed why he doesn't believe Jesus actually died on the cross. Does believe he was crucified but didn't actually die. Well, in response, we're going to be hearing from Canadian Christian apologist Tony Costa. They've met before, and we'll be hearing why Tony believes we can believe and be certain in the resurrection of Jesus. And this is the first of two programmes really looking at the resurrection. Next week we'll be looking at it with an atheist in the studio. But yes, really looking forward to our interaction today as we meet Shabir Ali. I've been wanting to get Shabir on this programme for a long time, so it's going to be great to have him on. That's to come shortly. Let me get some feedback, though, on the programmes of the last couple of weeks. Very, very, very positive response to David Robertson, who was on the programme for the last couple of weeks debating atheist Adrian Hayter. David, the author of the Dawkins Letters, Challenging Atheist Myths. Lots of you wanted to get in touch in regard to that. Let's start off, first of all, with Anthea. I always love Anthea's messages. They're very well thought out. Here's one that she dropped off in regard to the first programme.
Hello, Justin. Great debate on Saturday about atheist myths. There was a comment about Christians not being as clever as atheists. Well, of course it's true. That Francis Collins, he's not too clever. That C.S. Lewis, he's a well-known village idiot. Dorothy Sayers, who reads her stuff anyway? John Polkinghorne, thinks he can read the stars? Not without a sat-nav. Martin Luther King, well, not very bright, was he? Or influential. David Suchet, he's not much of an actor. Harriet Tubman, well-known coward. John Taverner, I reckon he's tone-deaf. Anne Atkins, she's not very bright. Francis Schaeffer, well, he's as dim as a 10-watt bulb. And Alan Titchmarsh, everything he grows dies. I'll just take my tongue out of my cheek now and say bye-bye, and I'm really looking forward to the next part of the debate.
That is great fun, Anthea. You certainly got a sense of humour, and we'll be hearing another comment from you shortly because your value for money, as far as I'm concerned. We'll also hear some more of your comments by phone. Lots of comments by phone this last week. Here's a couple of emails, though. This one from Bram says, I'd like to thank you for a brilliant show the past couple of weeks. David Robertson's book, The Dawkins Letter, Challenging Atheist Myths, is a welcome addition to New Atheist Criticism. The publication of another book such as Mr. Robertson's might give one the false impression that the New Atheist arguments must be well formulated and cogent. However, even a cursory inspection of the academic literature excluded from New Atheist writings clearly indicates the contrary. Indeed, by recycling old arguments through the use of rhetoric, insults, and metaphysics disguised as science, Dawkins and co. are rather mere distractions to the discussion. As noted philosopher William Lane Craig has stated regarding an atheist colleague who crowned Stephen Hawking's argument against God in A Brief History of Time as the worst atheistic argument in the history of Western thought. Well, now, Craig says, with the publication of Richard Dawkins' central argument of his God delusion, which I've criticised elsewhere, the time has come, I think, to relieve Hawking of this weighty crown and to recognise Dawkins' accession to the throne. Thank you, Bram. You're in New Jersey in the USA. Closer to home, Reginald in Ipswich says, hello there. I'm not sure, but I think your young atheist said, why did God not say in Genesis there was a Big Bang, when we know now, with our knowledge of astrophysics in the 21st century, that we'd be more inclined to believe that the Bible was therefore true? First of all ancient texts are context-bound and historically dependent on their culture. Would they, in biblical times, understand our modern scientific culture? In the book Einstein's Universe, Nigel Calder writes, did God just say, let there be light, meaning gamma rays, and the Big Bang ensued? Or did the energy come from somewhere else, like before? Somewhere else has no strict meaning, yet we can still sense the intention of the question. So you see clearly that in a sense God did say, let there be light, gamma rays, and there was one almighty bang. Thank you very much, Reginald. If you want to get in touch the programme today via email, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you want to phone in your comment, as we're about to play some of those comments from the show for last week, then it's 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. Don't forget to visit the webpage to actually listen back to the programme of the last couple of weeks, these discussions between David Robertson, our Christian, and Adrian Hayter, our atheist. That's at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Lots of people also choose to download the podcast regularly. You can find a way of doing that there as well. And why not, while you're there, click through to the Premier community? A fascinating discussion going on actually at the moment on a sort of side issue that came out of last week's programme, which was the conversion of an atheist to Christianity through, if you like, David's ministry, Richard Morgan. And Just an interesting discussion going on his story, and Richard himself and David both contributing to that discussion. So again, you can reach the Unbelievable group of the Premier community by going to the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. Now, there were a wide variety of responses to last week's programme, which just gives you an idea of the scope of the types of things we discussed. So we'll be hearing in these callers views on evolutionary morality, whether foreknowledge cancels out our free will, Dawkins' motivations, and the indoctrination of children. But let's start with another comment from Anthea on one of the claims made in the first programme that we heard.
On your show on Saturday, the two atheist speakers were openly stating that discrimination against Christians is all right because they have chosen their beliefs, and discrimination against black people is wrong because you don't choose your colour. I find that so comforting as a black Christian. I wonder which half of me they're going to discriminate against. And also, of course, by the extension of this logic, Robert Mugabe is perfectly correct in oppressing those who vote for the opposition party, because after all, they chose to do that. The people who were thrown into the gulag under Stalin, that's okay, because they chose to write books and do other things that offended his totalitarian beliefs. The problem with the principle is that it needs to be applied comprehensively, if not universally. So that's a principle that really could cause to be them to be, as my father would have put it years ago, hoist by their own petard. Mr. Robertson from Scotland was excellent, and I'm actually quite tempted to buy his book as a consequence.
Oh, hi, my name is Peter. I've just been listening to the programme about what might be favourable or not in terms of evolutionary theory. And I was thinking that Genghis Khan has got something like 5% of the current population of the world who are kind of descended from him. And his behaviour, I think most people would warrant to be absolutely atrocious. I think it's only if you have a system of absolute morality that you can say that.
Yes, just a thought without going into a huge discourse. Watching something happen, knowing it's going to happen, and knowing when it's going to happen, is not the same as making or forcing the happening. I'll give you an example. If a man says to another man, I know where the sun is going to rise, I know the time it's going to rise. I can point to the horizon where it will appear. And sure enough, the next day, as he points his finger, the sun arises at that point. That doesn't mean to say the man who knows that made it happen. My name's Arnie. God bless you, and to all the saints.
I'm Sim, sometimes called Lynn. We're hearing so much about Dorking and his book, but I've never heard about his growing up, how he was brought up, what kind of father he is, what kind of husband, what kind of boss he is. We don't know where this God hatred began. So let's hear something about his life, please. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hello, my name is Gillian Marlowe. On the question of being indoctrinated into Christianity from a very young age, I actually came to accept Jesus as my saviour at the age of 47 when a Jehovah's Witness called round my house, called Dorothy, tried to convince me that Jesus was Michael the Archangel. And when I actually went and studied the Bible, I discovered that he was in fact God and part of the Trinity. And I also found it a bit intriguing that the atheist who claimed to be intelligent would have blamed God when he gets to heaven and finds out it's true, for not making himself more easily known, when the people the atheist thinks are stupid actually believe in God and will be in heaven. I don't know how he's going to explain that, really. Anyway, thanks very much. Bye.
Well, thanks to everyone who has been getting in touch. And as I say, you're welcome to get in touch in response to today's programme. We're going to be meeting Shabir Ali and also our Canadian apologist, Tony Costa, in a short moment's time. Once again, if you want to listen to the discussion shows of the last couple of weeks featuring David Robertson and Adrian Hayter, do visit the Unbelievable webpage at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. I'm also going to put up a link with today's programme when this goes live on the webpage to the TV recording, the premier.tv recording of the discussion between two men, Michael Bird and James Crossley. You may remember they contributed to this programme back in January on the origins of Christianity, a Christian and a non-believer, both historians though, both church historians, looking at the origins of Christianity. We've got, if you like, the TV version, a shorter version of that now available. So I'm posting the link with this programme at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. And finally, also news this week that Premier have launched a campaign called I Am a Christian. It's in response to the National Secular Society, who have been running a de-baptism campaign. Don't know if you've heard of that, but you can actually get hold of a certificate now via them to say that you have been officially de-baptised, or unofficially really de-baptised. You no longer believe what those parents perhaps said over you at baptism. Premier are running in response a campaign called I Am a Christian, where we're looking for 100,000 Christians to sign up to that, to say that they believe the historic creeds of the Christian faith. If you want to sign up yourself, then do go to iamachristian.co.uk. Okay, time to meet our guests as we look at the question of the resurrection of Jesus Christ.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome to the programme. It's Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley, and really looking forward to today's edition of the show. We've got the topic that we have done in many ways in other shows, did Jesus rise from the dead? But a particular slant on it, if you like, this week. It's my great pleasure to welcome into the studio Shabir Ali, who is someone I've long wanted to have on the programme. Shabir, if you know anything at all about the world of Muslim-Christian interactions and faith discussion, he really has been a leading figure in that for a long, long time. He's based out in Toronto in Canada. He's just been over in the UK for a week or two, and so I was able to secure him here in the studio for the show. So a very warm welcome to you today, Shabir. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Justin. It's my pleasure to be on.
It's great to have you. We've got from Canada, funnily enough, which is Shabir's own backyard, Tony Costa as our Christian guest on the programme today. Tony, also not a stranger to this show, actually. He's been on at least once or twice before. Tony is a minister out in Canada and a Christian apologist. Very much that's part of his ministry. He seeks to put a reasonable case forward for believing in Christianity, particularly in the resurrection. And that's how I got to know him. So a warm welcome to you as well, Tony.
Thank you, Justin. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
Well, thank you both for joining me, gentlemen. Perhaps start off with you, Shabir. Tell us a little bit about your background, how things got started for you as a Muslim.
Oh, when I was a youth, about 14 years old, the imam of our village came to invite my father and brother to the mosque. I listened intently to what he had to say. I thought he made sense. The mosque is there and we ought to popularize it. I started going. I knew very little about the Islamic faith at the time, but I was spurred on to learn the more I got engaged in prayer and reflection. And the more I learned about the religion of Islam, the more everything seemed to make sense to me. And I then took it seriously, and that became very much a part of my life as it is now.
And you've obviously devoted your life to really putting forward a reasonable case for Islam around the world. So tell us, how did that sort of itself get started as a particular...
That too evolved through a number of influences, but one of the most significant things I believe that got me started in that was that Jehovah's Witnesses and other missionaries for other faiths kept knocking on my door, trying to invite me to other faiths. And I thought that my faith had something to offer that, in fact, is better than that which they were inviting me towards. So I felt that as others are actively pursuing their interest in promoting their faith, I should very much be involved in doing the same for mine as well.
And what it's led to is, in many ways, a kind of very intellectual pursuit. You've been involved in debates all over the world with various people. Many of those can be seen these days, you know, by the medium of the internet, you know. And so where does that leave you? Do you ever sort of doubt the story of Islam, or do you feel more confident than you did when you started after all these years of interacting with others?
I believe it is a very much a part of the human composition to have doubts and misgivings, to think about things that are puzzling and then to search for the answers to those. So there are questions that pop into my mind, and I have a very curious mind. I then research the answers to those questions to every possible link that seems significant to me. Till in the end, I usually come out with a very satisfying response to that question. It may involve some modification of what I previously held, but on the whole, the final outcome for me is that I'm more impressed and thoroughly enthused with the message of Islam than I've ever been.
And do you feel Islam is a faith which lends itself to that kind of rigorous kind of analysis and debate?
I believe so. I believe that at the heart of it, Islam is a very simple theology. It promotes the idea of one God, which usually is the outcome of philosophical arguments for the existence of God. The precepts and practices of Islam are quite straightforward and usually have a very rational component in them, although most Muslims have not thought about the rational components. They've just simply ritualistically done what has been prescribed in the faith. But when one studies them, one sees that there are objectives, there are reasons, there are wisdom teachings behind the practices.
Well, I mean, you could equally be, for me, describing Christianity in that sense, but I'm sure Tony will have a similar sort of view of the way he looks at his Christian faith. Tony, thanks for being with us on the programme today. Do tell us a bit about your own background as well, Tony, how things started off for you as a Christian.
Well, oddly enough, mine seems to be the Christian parallel of Shabir's.
Mm.
I was raised in a Roman Catholic home, a very devout religious Roman Catholic home, and went to Mass every Sunday, the sacraments, etc. But one thing I always noticed, Justin, was that there was always an emptiness in my life. I knew about God. I knew that he was the creator, preserver, the sustainer of the universe, but I never had a personal relationship with this God. And so I went in somewhat of a spiritual quest, trying to figure out if there was anything behind the truth of Christianity, the tradition that I was raised with. And it really wasn't until about the age of 15 that I was challenged by two of my cousins who had claimed to have had this salvation experience. They talked about being born again. And that really struck my ears as very odd. I never heard this term, born again. And so they challenged me to take up the Bible and just to give it a shot, to read it and to examine it for myself. And so I took up the challenge. I was actually set on going out to disprove them because I saw them as apostates from my Roman Catholic roots.
Mm.
When I read the Bible, I mean right from Genesis through to Revelation, the whole entire Bible, I was convicted immensely. Particularly, I was attracted to the person of Jesus of Nazareth. I found him to be a very magnetic figure, a very provocative figure, and his words truly pierced my heart. And I came to a point in my life where I began to understand that that knowing God was not simply knowing about him, but knowing him personally. And I came to the conviction that Jesus was who he said he was, that he was God's son, that he was the risen Lord, the one who conquered death and conquered the grave. And I gave my life to him. I accepted him as Savior and as Lord. But then there arose within me a thirst for knowledge. I wanted to know, could this really be defended? Is this just blind faith? Is there meat to this? And so this led me on an intellectual quest. It led me into university studies, where I obtained a bachelor's and master's of arts from the University of Toronto in religious studies, particularly in biblical studies. And now I'm currently a PhD candidate in New Testament studies. And so what I have found was when the Jehovah's Witnesses came to my door, they started knocking on my door, it challenged me also to examine my faith a little more closely. And what I came to realize was that Christianity is very rational, that it is consistent with the worldview that we see in the Bible, and it is also consistent with what it tells us about the world, man's alienation from God, the depravity of sin in the life of people, what it does to people, and that people are in desperate need of redemption by their Creator.
Now, this isn't the first time you've met Shabir, because obviously you're not far from each other over in Toronto, both based now in Toronto in Canada. So what have you made of your interactions thus far?
Well, Shabir and I go way back. I think the first time we had a debate was back in 1991, I believe. So Shabir and I go way back, and we're good friends. We've kept in touch, and over the years we've interacted through debates and dialogues at various universities in Canada, particularly in the Toronto area and abroad. And I respect Shabir. I think that Shabir is an honest individual when it comes to his faith and to his scriptures. We have some major differences in theology when it comes to the person of God and the person of Jesus. But I think Shabir is a gentleman, and I enjoy interacting with him.
Mm. Well, I'm sure you would say similar things about Tony.
Yes, thank you, Tony. That obviously is mutual. I have great respect for you and love for you. I see you as a very honest individual, very serious about your faith, and I really have fond memories of our interactions. I think these were scholarly interactions, and they were interactions in which we preserve the decorum that should be expected of Muslims and Christians. Too often in dialogues and debates, we get a very heated atmosphere that lends more credibility to the atheist argument, which says that people of religion do nothing but quarrel with each other. I think people of religion should reflect the basic teachings of religious ethics, which speak of respect for other individuals and kindness in our treatment of them.
Well, thank you both for joining me, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion today as we look at the question, did Jesus rise from the dead? And we're going to be hearing from Shabir, our Muslim imam in the studio today, why he doesn't believe that is the case, and he's going to be spelling out what he believes happened to Jesus in terms of the crucifixion resurrection story. We'll also be hearing from Tony why he does believe that Jesus did rise from the dead, and why there are very good reasons to believe that as a Christian. So a fascinating discussion as we draw very close to Easter at this time. Do hope you can stay with me right through till 4 o'clock this afternoon. If you're listening online or via podcast, you're also welcome to check out the web pages of both my guests today. I'm posting that information alongside the podcast, so do check those out. For Shabir, it's islaminfo.com, and for Tony, freewebs.com/Tony Cox.
This podcast is an outreach of Premier Insight and can only come to you each week through the support of listeners like you. Your support today is so important that we want to thank you for your gift by giving you a copy of Premier Insight's brand new ebook on artificial intelligence called The Robot Race. In it, two experts in AI and robotics discuss the implications of AI technology and explore what we can learn about the human race in the light of AI's growing capabilities. You'll gain insights into how your Christian faith can inform your view of this world-changing technology and its implications on your life and the future of humanity. Again, this ebook is our thanks to you for your gift in support of this program to help equip more Christians to confidently discuss their faith as it intersects with every aspect of life. To get your copy of The Robot Race, simply go to premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. That's premierinsight.org/unbelievableshow. Thank you for your support.
So we'll be getting into our discussion in just a couple of minutes' time here on the show that gets Christians and non-Christians talking.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
You certainly are. And my great pleasure to have on with me today Shabir Ali, who is well known in the Muslim world for his defence of the Muslim faith, of Islam. And he hails from Toronto in Canada, also the place where our other guest, coming to us by phone from there, comes from. He is Tony Costa. He's a Christian apologist. And he, for a long time now, has looked in some depth at the issue we're looking at today, the resurrection of Jesus Christ. For Tony, it is the very centrepiece of the Christian faith. But Shabir, as a Muslim, has a very different idea about that whole concept. He doesn't believe Jesus rose from the dead. He's going to be explaining how he sees that whole story. And we're going to be hearing a response from Tony on that basis. So a really interesting program for you this afternoon here on Unbelievable. Well, I think perhaps I'm trying to decide who it would be best to start with today, whether we sort of go for the positive or, if you like, the negative view on the idea of whether Jesus rose from the dead. But perhaps, Tony, would you like to spell out at least maybe some of the essentials of why you believe the resurrection of Jesus is a fact, isn't just a story, isn't just a myth, really is a fact. It did happen as described in the Gospels.
Certainly. Well, from the earliest time, the earliest period of Christianity, it's an undisputable fact that the early Christians believed in two central cardinal points about the historic Jesus, namely that he died by the form of execution known as crucifixion in the first century. And several days after his death, they discovered his tomb to be empty and experienced post-mortem appearances of Jesus alive again. And what is interesting, Justin, is that the earliest Christians interpreted this event as resurrection. They used the language of being raised from the dead. And that was the language for the first century Jew and even Second Temple Judaism, which meant the raising of the dead man, the corpse, from the grave by God. And so if I can just start off by just mentioning five basic points that historians and New Testament scholars are generally agreed on as historical facts about the historic Jesus, if I can just lay them out.
Go ahead.
And the five points are basically the crucifixion of Jesus, his honorable burial, his empty tomb, post-mortem appearances, and as a cumulative conclusion, the origin of the Christian way. If you take the first point, for example, the crucifixion of Jesus, it's important to stress here that the crucifixion of Jesus is also seen as the death of Jesus. This was not an apparent death. This was not a swoon that Jesus experienced on the cross, but that the crucifixion of Jesus was the very death of Jesus. In fact, the radical scholar Bart Ehrman, whom you've had on your show a couple of times, he himself stated, quote, "It is a historical fact that some of Jesus' followers came to believe that he had been raised from the dead soon after his execution." And so the belief that Jesus died on the cross is universal among scholarship and historians. The only ones that deny it are those who deny Jesus existed. And so the crucifixion of Jesus is fundamental to this. Secondly, we have the historical fact of Jesus' honorable burial. Most scholars consider this probably one of the most historically accurate pictures of Jesus, his honorable burial by Joseph of Arimathea. And therefore, the honorable burial of Jesus also shows us that the location of his tomb was known to both follower and foe alike. The third point would be the discovery of the empty tomb of Jesus. All the Gospels are agreed on this point, that on the third day following Jesus' execution, a number of his women disciples discovered his tomb to be empty. Now, our earliest writer, Paul himself, when he writes in 1 Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 4, he delivers to the Church of Corinth a creed which most scholars believe are pre-Pauline. That is, it comes doesn't come from Paul. It comes from the earlier disciples who followed Jesus. Paul delivers to them three basic points. He says that, "I deliver to you what I received, namely that Christ died for us, for our sins, according to the Scriptures, and that he was buried, and that he was raised again." So even Paul, our earliest writer, does know about the burial tradition and also the raising of Jesus from the dead. And therefore,
and this is significant because for those who would say, well, the resurrection of Jesus, that was just a kind of myth that sprung up over the next 100 years or something.
That's correct.
Shows just how early on people, obviously, the Christian
That's
community
correct.
Believed in it.
Mm. And that creed that you find in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4, James D.G. Dunn, who hails from your country, James Dunn himself argues that that creed comes within 3 years after the death of Jesus, so that what you have there is perhaps the earliest creed that we have within the New Testament concerning the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The other fact that scholars are agreed on is that after the discovery of the empty tomb, the early disciples experienced post-mortem appearances of Jesus. That is, they had experiences where they saw Jesus alive again, where he communed with them and commissioned them on their mission to the world. And so you have the post-mortem appearances. And then if you take all of these points together, the death of Jesus, his burial, the discovery of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, the only conclusion that these early Christians came to, and this is consistent throughout the pages of the New Testament, is that God raised Jesus from the dead. Now, of course, scholarship can only go so far. They use the historical critical method, which restricts them when it comes to the area of metaphysics. When it comes to the question of miracles and intervention by God, historical critical scholarship stops at that point. They can't go beyond what we have on the historical documentation. But it's interesting, Justin, that on these five points, there is unanimous agreement that the facts do bear out that Jesus died. And that's very important because from my past conversations with Shabir doesn't believe that Jesus actually died on the cross. But scholarship is unanimous that he not only died on the cross, that he was given an honorable burial, that his tomb was discovered to be empty, that the disciples experienced post-mortem appearances, but that they interpreted that in terms of resurrection. The language they employed was resurrection. And so if we're going to deny that Jesus did not die on the cross, if we assert that he did not die on the cross, then we have to explain why it is the early Christians used the language of resurrection instead of assumption or translation into heaven.
Well, you're obviously anticipating, I can see, what Shabir may be saying. But let's, obviously, we'll come back to you, Tony, in a moment. So, Shabir, obviously, you must have heard this many times. These are very often put as the, you know, five key things that, for Christian apologists, are real pillars, if you like, of the case for the resurrection. As a Muslim, what do you actually believe happened? What is your view of the Gospels and what they say, and what the Quran says about what happened to Jesus Christ?
Well, when we speak of Muslim belief regarding this, we should place the belief of Muslims regarding the final end of Jesus within the wider context of other beliefs of Muslims. And we'll see that this is actually a peripheral belief. While it is necessary for Muslims to believe in all of the prophets of God, including Jesus, and especially Jesus, the specific manner in which he met his end is not spelled out in any great detail in the Quran. And while Muslims believe in some 124,000 prophets, we don't have to know the precise method or manner in which each one of them exited the world. Some may have died natural deaths. Some may have been assumed into heaven by God, as in the case of Enoch or Elijah. In the case of Jesus, we have a curious narrative in the Quran that says that whereas the Jews boasted that they killed Jesus, the Messiah, the son of Mary, they neither killed him nor crucified him, but it was only made so to appear to them. And those who differ about the matter are in doubt concerning it. They have no certain knowledge except to follow a conjecture, but they killed him not for certain, whereas God raised him to himself. What precisely is meant by this is not entirely clear, because the Muslim commentators in the classical period have offered a wide variety of interpretations on this. Mostly, they said that someone else was substituted for Jesus on the cross. Jesus was taken into heaven, while the other person made to resemble Jesus was crucified instead. But I have followed the rethinking of many exegetes on this passage, who feel that it is not necessary to have that belief that someone else was substituted for Jesus.
The Quran doesn't make it necessary that that's the interpretation you carry.
Yes. What the Quran seems to be saying here is that they did not kill Jesus by some ordinary means, nor did they kill him by the specific means of crucifixion. We find this usage elsewhere in the Quran as well. In Surah 5, verse number 33, we have the juxtaposition of the two same terms, killed, crucified. And in that verse as well, it seems that the word killed in the Quran means killing by some ordinary means, whereas crucifixion means to kill by the specific method known as crucifixion. We also see in the stories of the Pharaoh and the magicians that worked for him who came to believe in the prophet Moses, the Pharaoh threatened them that if they were to maintain their new belief in the prophet Moses, he would have them crucified. This is mentioned in three places in the Quran. In two of these places, Yusuf Ali, who is a famous and popular commentator on translator of the Quran among Muslims, translates this passage as the Pharaoh threatening, "I will cause your death by crucifixion." This can be seen in Surah 7, verse 124, and Surah 26, verse number 49. When all of this is put together, it seems that the Quran is saying that though the Jews had attempted, and we're not speaking of all Jews, we're speaking about those opponents of Jesus at the time, because he and his followers at the time were Jews as well. But his Jewish opponents, who wanted him dead, boast eventually that they have killed him, whereas in fact they were in doubt as to whether they had actually accomplished the final goal of crucifixion by actually killing him. And there are statements in the Gospels, as they survive to this day, indicating that despite the outward text, which is emphasizing the death of Jesus, there is a subtext which points to the real fact that Jesus could not be verified to have died on the cross, and he very well may have been taken down while still alive.
Okay, so you're obviously bringing us to a conclusion that Jesus didn't actually die on the cross, that he came down alive from the cross. So from your point of view then, what is the resurrection and all of those testimonies in the gospel about? Was it just a hallucination or a false belief? What's going on with those stories?
Well, to make sense of these stories, the scholars looking at them observe the manner in which they have the appearance of later legend now written after the fact. They're not blow-by-blow accounts of what happened as they happened. We can notice, for example, in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 27, the women went to the tomb early in the Sunday morning. They found the tomb empty. An angel told them the whole story of what happened. In fact, it appears that they saw the angel coming down, rolling the stone away, showing them that the tomb is empty, telling them that Jesus has now resurrected. They leave the scene with great joy to go and tell the disciples, but on the way they actually meet Jesus. They see him and they touch his feet and worship him. But in John chapter 20, Mary Magdalene returns from the tomb saying to the disciples, "They have taken away the Lord, and we do not know where they have put him." Why would she say a thing like that if she had just seen and touched and worshipped Jesus? Noticing contradictions like this, scholars can form the reasonable conclusion that these stories are written by various individuals based on oral reports that were circulating at the time and developing in many different areas, and that they are not blow-by-blow accounts of factually what happened. So scholars have to form some theories of what might be the most reasonable way of putting all of these reports together, what needs to be definitely shaved off and what could be retained. So some scholars will hold that the tomb was first discovered empty, and that led to the later belief that Jesus must have risen from the dead. And with that belief in mind, the disciples began to experience appearances of him, which was only in their own minds, not in fact. Some other scholars start from the other direction, thinking that the disciples may have fled from Galilee, fled from Jerusalem once Jesus was arrested, gone back to Galilee after he was crucified or sometime in this period. And eventually, when they went about their fishing as they normally did, they began to see Jesus in the familiar scenes, something like what is reported in John chapter 21. And based on this sort of experience, which again was all in their own minds, they now reconstructed the story that the tomb was found empty. Some others think that the discovery of the tomb was independent, but most scholars would think that it's reconstructed one way or another to make sense of the whole thing.
Well, obviously, two very, very different views represented then this afternoon on what happened, even down to the fact of whether Jesus really died on the cross, and that seems to be the first kind of major stumbling block in terms of a point of divergence, obviously, between yourself, Shabir, and Tony. You're listening to Unbelievable. We're asking, did Jesus rise from the dead? And I suppose we could also just as equally be asking, did he actually die on the cross? Because that seems to be a fundamental part of what we're talking about today as well, with Shabir Ali from Toronto and Tony Costa coming to us live from Toronto by phone. If you'd like to get in touch, do email unbelievable@premier.org.uk or phone 08456 52 52 52 and select option 5. I'd be delighted to receive your messages, play them out or read them out on next week's show, and indeed pass along any relevant ones to our guests. So those are the numbers and the way to get in touch by email, and we'll be continuing this debate in a short moment.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So, Tony, what's your initial response to all those things that Shabir had to say just now?
Well, first, to start off with, I think it's important to stress that Shabir's position on the crucifixion of Jesus is really one that most Muslims would see as at variance with classical Islam. Classical Islam, Sunni and Shiite, has always interpreted the Quran in Surah 4, Ayah 157, as showing that Jesus was neither killed nor crucified. I believe the Arabic is wa ma'a kataluhu wa ma'a talabuhu. And so you have to realize that Shabir has, in effect, he has set his face against the position of classical Islam in this area. Shabir's position is actually one that is not really new at all. It's actually held by the Ahmadiyya sect of Islam that also holds to the view that Jesus was crucified, but he merely swooned. But what Shabir is proposing is something that was proposed in the late 1700s and early 1800s. It was known as the swoon theory, or the apparent death theory, proposed by a number of scholars who try to explain the empty tomb. How do you get around an empty tomb if Jesus was really dead? And so they argued that, in fact, what happened was Jesus wasn't really dead. He was rendered into a deep state of unconsciousness, and that he revived in the tomb. The German scholar, David Friedrich Strauss, in his classical work, back as 1835, he dealt really the death blow to this theory in his book, Das Leben Jesu, The Life of Jesus Critically Examined. Strauss denied all the miracles in the Gospels. He denied all the supernatural events. He concluded that the apparent death theory, or the swoon theory, was really held no water, because it cannot explain the high Christology that we find in the New Testament does not explain the worship of Jesus in the New Testament. There is no way that early Christians would have regarded Jesus in divine terms if he merely escaped death by the skin of his teeth. It doesn't make any sense. Now, the way Shabir is approaching the Gospels here is he's approaching them from what's known as a form-critical analysis. He's looking at the Gospel stories, and he sees layers of traditions in them, written by various hands, etc. But it is still undeniable that the core message of the Christian church has always been that Jesus died, that he was buried, and that he was raised again. And on this point, we can call scholars from the far left wing, like Bart Ehrman and Gerd Ludemann, and these scholars would readily admit that the death of Jesus was a reality. And so I think the burden of proof is really on Shabir here to show that Jesus really was not dead. I don't think he's provided any evidence thus far. I don't think he's shown any proof here that Jesus was not dead. And we also have to explain why it is that the disciples of Jesus, whom the Quran speaks very favorably about, why Allah would cause the disciples of Jesus to go about preaching that Jesus had died and risen from the dead and thereby foist this great error upon the world.
And so is it your view then, Shabir, just to get this absolutely right, that Jesus did not die on the cross, he swooned as it were, so he appeared to be dead, was taken down, and you believe was put in the tomb, but revived in the way that that Tony has described, and that the disciples put up on this, or later on there was this turned into, if you like, that Jesus resurrected? Is that what I'm getting?
What I should clarify is that my belief is based on the Quranic text. I can try to fill out the basic narrative of the Quranic text by looking at what the scriptures of the Christians say. And I can also look at the kinds of theories that are propounded by biblical scholars. But I would distinguish between what I believe as a necessary part of my Muslim faith and what I can hold to as a student of comparative religion and an investigator into these events. So my basic belief as a Muslim is that which the Quran says. They killed him not, nor did they crucify him. It was only made so to appear to them, and they have no clear knowledge regarding this. This is my belief as a Muslim. Mm-hmm. Now, what does this entail? What are the details? Tony seems to think that it would be obligatory for me to retain a kind of orthodoxy where I hold to the classical interpretations on this. But one would be surprised to see the variety of commentaries that were given in the classical texts regarding this. While the most commentators held the view that someone was substituted for Jesus, there was no clear understanding among them as to who that substitute was. Nor was their commentary based on anything that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, himself said, which is quite curious. How is it that no one asked him the meaning of this verse? It seems that their commentaries are based on stories that were gathered from Jewish and Christian sources. And in that case, we classify such stories as the Israeliyat, which are famously known to be held in suspicion among later Muslims.
Do you in some sense feel forced to ditch that classical view of the substitution of Jesus because the historical weight of evidence is so clearly strongly that Jesus himself was crucified?
I believe to hold to the classical view is an obstacle in our dialogue with Christians. If Muslims continue to deny that Jesus was actually put on the cross, when this the idea that Jesus was on the cross is so central to the Christian story, creates a stumbling block, a difficulty in our dialogue with people of the other faiths. And for this reason, much more so than the historical reason, I would prefer the interpretation, which actually brings into harmony the Quranic text with elements that are found in the Christian Bible. But the other, and I believe an equally important reason for this, is that the classical Muslim scholars in interpreting the Quran followed a well-known and acceptable method in that they looked at what the Quran said and they looked for the details of what the Quran is speaking about by turning to Jewish and Christian sources. They wanted to learn about the biblical scriptures, but they did not have direct access to the Bible. They got it from informers, and sometimes they got it incorrectly. Today, we have better access to the Christian scriptures. We can read them. I can read them. And we can see that what the Quran is referring to in brief is a more detailed story, and the details of that can be found in the Christian scriptures. When I look at the details, I see that the doubt that the Quran was referring to, what was the doubt that they had? The classical Muslim commentator said they doubted because while the face of the crucified victim looked like that of Jesus, the body remained in appearance to be that of the real crucified man. And so they had some doubt regarding this. But I find that in the Gospels themselves, there are instances where there is an expression showing that Jesus did not actually die. Think, for example, of Pilate wondering and being astonished that Jesus had died so soon. Usually crucifixion took a few days to kill a person. Josephus mentions once that when he returned to Jerusalem from Tekoa, he found three of his friends being crucified, and they had been hung for 3 days. He had them removed from the crosses and given medical attention, but one of them survived, the other two died. Notice that after 3 days, they were still alive. Jesus, according to the Gospel records, was only on the cross for 6 hours until he expired. So in that case, we must ask what killed him, because as Raymond Brown said, crucifixion does not pierce any vital organ of the crucified victim.
How do you respond to that, Tony?
If I can just, maybe Shabir can respond to this, but I'll address what he just said, but I'd like Shabir maybe to cite one, any Islamic commentator that he knows of that believes that Jesus was actually crucified. I'd like to know if he knows of any commentators from...
In the classical period, Tony, no. I readily admit that when I look at the classical commentators, they universally held that someone was substituted for Jesus. But notice the methodology here. You should not insist that Muslims follow every classical interpretation of the Quran. While Muslims are required to believe in the Quranic text as being from the Word of God, the commentators sometimes have been off the mark. Though they were great commentators, and we start our learning of the exegetical tradition by studying their works, we have to have the willingness to go beyond that.
I appreciate your critical analysis. I'm just surprised, however, that, as you know, the Muslim community also follows the Ummah, the community of faith, and the leadership. But I'm just interested to know what has convinced you that that Jesus was actually crucified. What were the considerations you put into effect that brought you to this understanding that Jesus was in fact crucified?
You mean to use one meaning of crucifixion?
Well,
because
what
notice that I'm distinguishing between two meanings here. One meaning of crucifixion is just simply to hang on a cross. When Mark's gospel says, for example, it was the third hour when they crucified him, obviously he has in mind that first meaning.
Well, I understand. I'm just asking, yes. Shabir, what led you to the understanding that Jesus was in fact crucified?
I think I've just explained that. What I've said is that in looking at for harmony between the Muslim and Christian scriptures, I find that the Quran is speaking of something here which is readily identifiable in the Christian scriptures without the need to resort to the classical Quranic interpretation which says that someone was substituted for Jesus.
Right, so you find the gospel records, you find them reliable in this area.
No, not that I find them reliable in this area, but I find that there is no reason to reject this particular aspect of the Christian gospels.
And okay, on what basis do you say that?
Prima facie, there is no reason for a Muslim to look at the Quranic verse in Surah 4, verse 157, and then turn to the Gospels and say, oh, well, we can't accept the idea that Jesus was put on the cross. That is what the classical Muslim commentators did, because they took the word crucifixion in both of its meanings. They neither hung him on the cross, and by extension, that means they didn't kill him by crucifixion. But I believe that the word crucifixion as used in the Quran means to kill a person by that means, and the Quranic denial that when it says Masalabuhu, as you rightly read it, it means they did not kill him by this specific method of crucifixion.
We're going to have to just take a quick break here, but I'll allow you to come back, Tony, because I think you're working up to kind of a particular point here. And we'll also, of course, have your response to Shabir's contention that there are clues in the Gospels that Jesus didn't really die. You're listening to a programme, Unbelievable, Christian and non-Christians discuss here every week. Shabir Ali, Muslim imam and notable Muslim thinker, is with me in the studio. He's in debate with Tony Costa, who's coming to us on the phone from Toronto in Canada. Tony is a Christian. We're asking, did Jesus rise from the dead? Keep listening. We'll be back in a short moment. Welcome back to the programme. Well, as we continue with our Easter theme next week, we're also going to be looking at the resurrection. Slightly different point of view. We'll have an atheist response to that. Stephen Carr is a prolific presence in the atheist internet world, and we're going to be re-airing a debate he took part in on whether Jesus rose from the dead. He claims Christians in the early church were at odds with each other on the idea of the resurrection, so we should have no trust in believing it either. Canon Michael Cole is our Christian next week, defending the resurrection. Do listen out for that this time next week here on the programme.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Did Jesus rise from the dead? Indeed, did he even die on the cross? Well, Shabir Ali, who is a well-known Muslim speaker and thinker and imam, says that he doesn't believe Jesus died on the cross, and that for that very reason he didn't rise from the dead either. Indeed, he says that the whole concept of Jesus' resurrection is something of a mythology that kind of came about later on, we can't trust the gospel accounts on this sort of reading. And that very much ties into his beliefs as a Muslim, that the Quran does not support the idea of Jesus either being the Son of God or rising from the dead. So we're going to be continuing to hear from Tony Costa as he replies to this contention from Shabir. Tony himself is a Christian apologist based out in Canada, where Shabir is also from. Okay, so Tony, you were just sort of, when I had to interject in the last segment, kind of, I thought, working up to something along the lines of, I'm getting the feeling you believe that Shabir has actually been forced to this belief that Jesus really did get crucified, even if he doesn't believe he died on the cross, by presumably the weight of historical evidence.
I think that's exactly the case. I think that the weight of the evidence presented in the Gospels, not only the Gospels, but even the earliest Christian writer Paul, is so overwhelming that the tradition that Jesus was crucified could not have possibly been made up. And what I'm hearing from Shabir, Surah 4:157 is the only text in the Quran composed of 40 Arabic words that say anything about Jesus being crucified. And I'm just interested in the fact that Shabir is willing to concede the point that Jesus was placed on the cross. And outside of the New Testament, I can't see what other source Shabir would be alluding to in support of his contention that Jesus was crucified.
Yeah, I think what you would like to hear from me, Tony, is that I should speak as a historian and agree that the placement of Jesus on the cross was a historical fact. I'm not here to speak as a historian. I speak as a Muslim theologian. And what I see is that the Quran says that they neither killed him nor crucified him. And from seeing that, I have no reason to go to the Gospels and say, well, they didn't even put him on the cross. Because though that is one of the meanings of crucifixion, I see that the meaning that the Quran here is using in denying the crucifixion, if you will, is that the Quran is denying that they actually fulfilled the goal of crucifixion by actually killing him through that method.
I mean, so I have to admit myself, and I'm totally new to this whole area myself, Shabir, but on the face of it, that verse from the Quran, they neither killed him nor crucified him, it makes it sound exactly what Tony, I think, would assume, which is that they didn't put him on a cross.
And this is what the classical Muslim exegetes assume, but that's because they went by the surface meaning of this verse.
I just wonder, wouldn't it have made sense to, if they really didn't mean that, to have made it clear that they did crucify him, but he didn't die? I mean, if that is actually what was intended originally.
Perhaps we can ask God to restate all of his scriptures, the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Quran, and there will be no work for exegetes. What the classical Muslim exegetes failed to do here was to tie in the use of this word, salb, which means crucifixion, with other uses of the same word everywhere else in the Quran. There are about six places in the Quran altogether where this word is used, and in every case, it always means to kill by a method known as crucifixion. So it can have theoretically another meaning outside of the Quran. The word can be used to indicate just merely hanging a person on the cross, but that's not how the word is used in the Quran itself. Though the Quran is not denying that possible meaning, but in this passage and in everywhere else where the Quran is using the term, it always means to kill a person by the specific means of crucifixion.
Okay. Well, I feel we should probably, gentlemen, move on from this point. But Tony, I mean, would you kind of, I mean, take maybe on Shabir's next points now, which are the whole area of, well, are there other parts of the gospel which would suggest that Jesus didn't actually die and support a swoon
theory? No, I don't see that at all. I don't see that at all, unless you're looking for it. I mean, if you look at the earliest gospel, Mark, which Shabir cited earlier, Shabir cites the example of Flavius Josephus, where he talks about how a number of his friends were crucified and two of them survived. One died. He pled with the emperor to release them. This doesn't, of course, mean that all crucified victims survived for a couple of days. If you look at the earliest Gospel of Mark, yes, we are told in Mark 15:44 that Pilate marveled that Jesus was already dead, but we're also told that he called a centurion and asked him whether he could certify or verify that Jesus was indeed dead. And after his death was certified, if you will, the death certificate was issued, then the body was released to Joseph of Arimathea. And so the gospel makes clear here that Jesus was certifiably dead. In fact, if you look at the language that Mark employs in his Greek text, he uses the Greek word ekpaneo, and that word literally means to breathe out. It means to die, to breathe one's last, to engage in the final act of dying. And so even the language which is employed by the gospel writers make it very clear that Jesus gave up the ghost, as it were. And so I don't see why it is that Shabir seems to think that the gospels are trying to hide something from us here. Because
I'll tell you why, Tony.
If Jesus did not, in fact, die on the cross, again, this idea that the resurrection was a myth that evolved, I mean, this is part of the history of religion school, which really is passé now. I mean, the view of the resurrection of Jesus is so early that James D.G. Dunn points out that the creed found in 1 Corinthians 15:3-4 emerged within the Christian community within 3 years after the death of Jesus, which is hardly enough time for legend to accrue.
This is a key point, I think, and one I think that you will need to answer, Shabir. But it seems, first of all, you want to keep going on your point that, for whatever reason, you believe that the Gospels do have this underlying story which you speak of, that Jesus didn't actually die. I mean, how can that be, given it is so clear that that's what Mark is saying, he died,
yes.
And you're drawing on aspects which say that's not so?
Yes, I'm saying that while the surface text of Mark and others are insisting that Jesus died, and they're trying to prove that even, there is a subtext which shows that there were indications that he didn't actually die. For example, the amazement of Pilate. Now, Tony says the centurion certified, but there is no such thing as certification mentioned in the Gospels. Pilate just simply asked the centurion, and he affirmed. The actual words of the centurion are not given. But notice that by this time, the centurion had become a believer in Jesus. He declared, according to Mark, truly this man was the Son of God. The centurion, therefore, would have no interest in seeing Jesus being killed by this time. Neither did Pilate ever apparently have an interest in Jesus being killed, because given the accounts in the Gospels, Pilate continually refused to have Jesus crucified, but only on the final insistence on the part of the Jewish opponents of Jesus that they will report this matter to Caesar, Pilate finally conceded. But if Pilate could find a way to save his own position while at the same time not having to go through with finally killing Jesus, then I don't see why he would not why he would not allow for Jesus to survive. So the whole process of certifying Jesus' death is in fact quite missing. The one thing that might have killed Jesus, if it were historically accurate, was the spear thrust that John spoke about. But John's spear thrust has to come, according to the narrative, if we piece them together with the synoptic narratives would have to come after the cosmic phenomena that the synoptic gospel spoke about. From 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the afternoon, there was a solar eclipse. The entire land was in darkness. At the time that Jesus breathed out his last, there was an earthquake, and the manner in which Jesus died caused the centurion and those with him, according to Matthew's gospel, to declare that this man was the Son of God. Now, who would have dared after this to go and thrust the side of Jesus with a spear? In the synoptic gospels, the response for this to this cosmic phenomena was humility on behalf of everyone, not only the centurion and those under him, the guards with him, but also the Jewish opponents of Jesus went away beating their breasts, obviously repentant over the fact that they had crucified an innocent man. So
it's a very interesting argument. What do you make of it, Tony?
Well, I still don't see the point. Pardon the expression, but I think we're really beating around the bush here. I mean, notwithstanding all of the cosmic phenomena that are recorded in the Gospels, I mean, the one who pierced the side of Jesus, we're not specifically told which of the soldiers this was. We're told in John's Gospel that to ensure that he was indeed dead, they pierced his side, and they would not break his legs as they did the criminal's legs. But I'm still trying to see what any of this has to do with the death of Jesus. We don't see these radical form critics of the New Testament, like Bart Ehrman, coming out and saying, you know, Jesus really wasn't dead. Mark's subtext indicates that Jesus was actually alive on the cross or put in the tomb alive. We don't see this.
I mean, this is a kind of line of thinking unique to Shabir, as far as you can tell.
Yeah, well, where is Shabir getting this from? I mean, the only commonality that I see with Shabir is a theory that arose in the 1700s and was put to sleep in 1835, or as I've said before, I mean,
put to sleep is a nice way of putting it.
Shabir's become Ahmadiyya. He's gone Ahmadiyya on it.
No, Tony, let me just mention something here that perhaps you're not familiar with. Robert Price, in his book Deconstructing Jesus, has actually given a sympathetic reading of the Muslim account on this, and he says that while Muslims have noticed for a long time that there are indications that Jesus did not actually die, there are other indications in the Gospels as well. And he has noted that not only in that one book, but also in the Incredible Shrinking Son of Man, and in his response to the Da Vinci Code, he has also made similar references. Think, for example, of the fact that in the New Testament Acts of the Apostles, when the disciples preached about Jesus' resurrection, the text that they cited from the Old Testament was Psalm 16. Now, the commentator on Psalm 16, the interpreter's one-volume commentary on the Bible, says that Psalm 16 refers to someone who has had a close brush with death. It's not about somebody who actually died, because notice that it says that his body did not see corruption. And we know that at the moment of death, corruption immediately sets in, though we do not notice that. So if Jesus' body did not become corrupt, then it means that he did not actually die. He was in a very deep sleep or coma.
If I could just respond to that question. Robert Price is probably considered the most left-wing fringe scholar. I mean, he denies Paul wrote 1 Corinthians. He denies Paul wrote Galatians. I mean, he holds to such extremist views that even Bart Ehrman has dismissed his allegations. I myself personally, I don't want to perform any ad hominem here, but based on Robert Price's research, I find it highly questionable. But let's get back to your question on
Yeah, but Tony, just on that point, don't say, though, that no one outside of Muslim circles will say this, because Robert Price, despite your views of him, has had training at the Dallas Theological Seminary.
Certainly.
He knows his New Testament. Testament scholars. They have a wide variety of views that are not shared by others. He particularly has views which are outside of Christian circles. We know that.
I think what Tony's trying to say is that even in the company of similar atheist, agnostic Bible scholars, he is considered to be right on the edge of what is considered to be scholarly kind of
And that may be so, but at the same time, forget that we are mentioning Muslim or we're mentioning Robert Price or we're mentioning Christian. Think about the actual elements on which I'm basing my argument. There are real indications that Jesus might not have died on the cross. Tell us then what actually caused his death. If you say the spear thrust and you say that one of the guards might have done this, what do you make of Matthew's gospel, which says says that not only the centurion, but all of the guards with him declared that Jesus is the Son of God. So well, you would have to have a guard outside of this circle who comes in to give the spear thrust.
Exactly. We're not.
And then you'd have to have a guard who didn't notice this cosmic phenomenon or is not scared by all of this. 3 hours of darkness throughout the land.
Let me just first answer your question on Psalm 16, then I'll get to the Gospels. First of all, in your appeal to Acts of the Apostles, there is no doubt that even in the preaching sermons of Peter and Paul, recorded in Acts, which are considered by scholarship to be very old and ancient, they mention the death of Jesus.
But I'm not denying that. So you have to deal with what I'm denying. I'm saying that there is a subtext. So you have to look at the subtext.
I'm trying to answer you. Yeah. In Psalm 16, you're right. In the immediate context of the Psalter, in Psalm 16, you're right. The psalmist has been delivered from the gates of death. There's no doubt about it. But the Christian use of that psalm, if you read the context in which Peter appeals to that psalm, he is making a contrast between the body of David, which is buried in Jerusalem, in his tomb, and the risen Jesus, who is no longer entombed. And he quotes that passage in a midrashic form. As you know, the Jews practiced midrash when they came to the exegesis of Old Testament texts. Peter appeals to that passage in support of the resurrection. Even though you're right, in its immediate context, it is a reference to being delivered from the gates of death. The way Peter used that text was actually to support the fact that Jesus' body was no longer in the tomb, that this Jesus, whom you killed, Peter says, God has raised.
I mean, I'd like us also, in a sense, to move on so that we're not just responding to Shabir's belief that Jesus didn't die on the cross. But Shabir, you're also responding to Tony's positive case, if you like, for the resurrection, a key part of which is 1 Corinthians 15, this early attested belief in the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. I mean, what do you make of that particular passage?
Well, I should say that this is not the only early attestation to Christian belief about Jesus. Earlier than the Gospels, we have evidence that the pre-Markan Gospel source actually spoke not of Jesus resurrecting from the dead, but being assumed from his tomb, assumed into heaven, translated or transported into heaven from his tomb. And this was attested to by Reginald Fuller in his formation of the Gospel narratives. And most recently, Daniel Smith, in his doctoral thesis, now published in the book The Postmortem Vindication of Jesus in the Saints' Gospel Q, done at the University of Toronto under John Kloppenberg, who is the premier Q scholar of the New Testament. Daniel Smith actually attests to this by citing a wide variety of sources to show that this was an earlier Christian belief than the one represented in the Gospels.
You're saying when you talk about this other document, Q, which Mark drew from in his Gospel, you're saying that even though we don't have access to this Gospel, there is a belief that that Gospel spoke of an assumption of Jesus from
There are two sources. There's the Gospel Q, which Mark did not necessarily draw from, and there is the pre-Markan Passion source that Mark is said to have drawn from. When we look at Mark, we see that Mark speaks of resurrection, but that's in verse number 7 of chapter 16. But Wolfhard Pannenberg and other scholars have held that the pre-Markan source of this did not include a mention of Jesus appearing to his disciples. And without that mention of Jesus appearing again to his disciples, what we have really is an account of an assumption of Jesus. Now, Dieter Zeller, a German scholar, actually holds that the sign of Jonah spoken about in the Q Gospel would involve, in its similarity with the case of Jesus, really an assumption of the alive Jesus. And that is very close to what Muslims have held.
Well, I'm going to give you a chance now to respond to that, Tony. And as I do that, let me say that if you're listening and you'd like to respond yourself to anything you're hearing on the program today, then you're welcome to get in touch by the normal method, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. And if you'd like to get in touch by phone, it's 08456 52 52 52, select option 5. I'd be interested to hear from you if you've been intrigued by the discussion that we're having on air this afternoon. And I'm happy to play or read your message out next week on the programme and indeed pass any relevant ones on to our guests here in the studio.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Don't forget, you can catch this programme as a podcast now at premier.org.uk/unbelievable, and plenty more if you scan back through the archive of Muslim-Christian dialogues and debates. I do encourage you to get hold of them and to listen if you're into this kind of area of discussion. So, Tony, your response to this pre-Markan story. Yeah.
Yeah, so the pre-Markan passion narrative has been dealt with by a number of scholars. Rudolf Pesch made this study famous. But what Rudolf Pesch has shown in the pre-Markan passion narrative is that it also included the empty tomb tradition, the empty tomb story that you find in Mark 16:1-8. And so I don't see how one could assume that assumption was the idea that the early Christians held to prior to the resurrection of Jesus. If you read Mark 16, you find the empty tomb. You find a young man at the tomb. He tells the women, he is not here, he is risen. And he tells them that he will go ahead and tell Peter that he will go ahead of you and he will meet you in Galilee. And so the postmortem appearances of Jesus are anticipated already at the end of Mark's gospel. And this view, Justin, that exaltation or assumption was the original view, this was something that Rudolf Bultmann back in the 50s was really spearheading. But most scholars today, including N.T. Wright, who wrote the tome, The Resurrection of the Son of God, he has shown persuasively that the earliest creed of the church was not the assumption of Jesus. They later believed that he ascended consequently to his resurrection, but that the earliest creed that you find again in 1 Corinthians 15, 3-4, which Paul passed on, was that Christ died for our sins, that he was buried, and that he was raised again on the third day. And so resurrection goes right back to the earliest beginnings of the Christian movement. And the ascension of Jesus was something that early Christians saw as consequent or subsequent to his resurrection.
And the post-mortem appearances, which form another pillar, if you like, of your argument, Tony, those
they appear also, in the earliest gospel.
Also are kind of, if you like, you can't have some assumed Jesus then appearing to people.
No, because the Jews realized the difference between a resurrection and assumption. If you look at the stories of Elijah and Enoch in the Old Testament, you will notice that Enoch and Elijah were assumed into heaven without dying. They were translated into heaven, and some believed the same thing happened to Moses. But they didn't speak of the resurrection of Elijah or the resurrection of Enoch. They spoke of the translation of Elijah and Enoch or the assumption. But this language is not used of Jesus. He is said to be raised from the dead, and exaltation carried within it the concept of resurrection, because the resurrection was the exaltation of the martyr, of the just martyr who died in faithfulness to God. And so I just don't see how it is that Shabir can avoid the early testimony of the resurrection of Jesus in earliest Christianity.
We're going to have to, unfortunately, draw things to a close, Shabir, and I would love to be able to extend it for an hour and we could keep going with responses and counter-responses. But would you like to just wrap up then for you yourself where we've got to as far as you're concerned on the program?
Well, I think it's very important to notice that scholars, even those cited by Tony Costa, would attest to a certain degree of development in the stories in the Gospels. James Dunn, for example, commenting on Luke's narrative about Jesus showing himself alive to his disciples, say that this is an early stage in which the resurrection was spoken about. He's just simply showing himself alive. And then you have the later sort of narratives which show that he shows himself to have flesh and bone, which is found in Luke's gospel. So there's a development in the story. You cannot take the latest sort of way of putting this and think of that as being the original story. If we keep in mind development, then does it go from assumption to resurrection, or does it go from resurrection to assumption? Does somebody first proclaim that Jesus resurrected from the dead, and somebody else later on thinking that he was just simply assumed into heaven? Or did it go the other way? Scholars think it went the other way. First, there was a view that Jesus was assumed from the tomb, which is now empty because Jesus was translated from the tomb into heaven. And then there are, tacked on to that, are later stories that Jesus now appeared to his disciples. And in order to make that possible, the ascension of Jesus is moved from being an original story about Jesus being assumed into heaven to have that come following the appearances. And then the ascension is actually given twice. So Luke has done it two ways. First, he's given us the ascension of Jesus on Easter evening. And then in order to make room for even more narratives, later on he gives us the ascension as having occurred 40 days after the crucifixion. So we can see that the original story of the assumption of Jesus from the tomb into heaven has now been moved by Luke, first as an ascension on Easter Day, and then second as an ascension some 40 days later, each time to make room for apparent stories which would give you the full-blown resurrection account.
Very interesting. Tony, your chance just to respond and give us your closing thoughts on this discussion this afternoon.
Well, I would just say that, once again, 1 Corinthians 15:3-4 is the earliest kernel of tradition that we have in this area. And even though there's development within Christianity, there's development even within Islamic theology. The view that the Word of God is eternal, as Montgomery Watt pointed out, was something that developed in early Islam. And so I have no problem with development within religious tradition. But we must not deny that behind that tradition, that development, there is a historical kernel or a historical core. And so that historical core, scholars have brought down to 5 points: death of Jesus, burial, the empty tomb, postmortem appearances, and the origin of the Christian way. And also, just in quick response to Shabir's statement there about ascension, Luke does not tell us in his gospel how much later Jesus ascended into heaven. He tells us in Acts that it was 40 days. But even if you take the fourth gospel, John is also aware of the ascension of Jesus, and it's not something that happens on the day of resurrection. John tells us that when Jesus meets Mary Magdalene, she comes to clasp him, and he says, "Do not touch me, do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father." And so John is aware of the fact that the ascension of Jesus is distinct from his resurrection, and they're not the same thing, and they should not be collapsed into the same thing as Shabir has done.
Well, it's been a fascinating discussion between you both, gentlemen, and it's been conducted, as I was sure it would be, in a spirit of friendly, you know, disagreement, but it has been friendly, and I've really learned an awful lot myself about, you know, where obviously you stand on it, Shabir, and some of the intricacies of why you would hold that position, and it's been very interesting to hear that. So thank you both for being on the programme today. I hope that perhaps next time you're in the country or at some point down the line, we might be able to get you in perhaps on a different subject. Shabir,
I'd love to.
It would be really interesting to hear from you, and also you, Tony.
Thank you so much for
contributing, and do get on with the rest of your day. It's a bit earlier on over there in Canada than it is here in the UK.
Right.
But thanks for being with me today.
Thank you so much.
God bless you. Thanks so much. That's Tony Costa and Shabir Ali. And if you want to get hold of either of their websites, you can find Shabir at islaminfo.com. And you can find Tony at freewebs.com/Tony Costa. And of course, you can find Unbelievable at premier.org.uk/Unbelievable, where you can now download this programme as a podcast. Thank you so much for listening this afternoon. And do get in touch, as I say, in regard to this programme. And I'd be delighted to get your feedback. That's all for today. Do join me again at the same time next week. Another fascinating discussion coming up for you then. You're unbelievable. Well, we've got another look at the resurrection of Jesus next week as we're joined by the internet atheist Stephen Carr. He's a prolific presence. If ever you've been in a Christian or atheist chat room, you may well have seen his name appear. He's going to be part of a debate that we're re-airing where he claims Jesus never rose from the dead because the fact is the early Christians were at odds over the idea of resurrection, and we should certainly have no trust in the idea either. Canon Michael Cole is our Christian next week defending the idea of the resurrection. So that's Easter Saturday's programme for you. Do hope you can join me for that between 2:30 and 4 o'clock, or indeed online at premier.org.uk/unbelievable.